Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast of Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. I'm Rob Crowther, and on this episode of ID the Future, we're joined by Dr. Doug Axe, biologist and director of research with the Biologic Institute. He's also a co-author of the new book from Discovery Institute Press, Science and Human Origins. In that book, Axe examines how good the Darwinian mechanism really is at inventing new things, especially the most significant thing that Darwinists claim the mechanism has done, namely in inventing human beings. Axe and his co-authors examine something far less complex, a simple change from one simple structure to another similar simple structure, and they find the Darwinian mechanism severely lacking. So we decided to interview him about science and human origins.
Thank you for being with us today, Dr. Axe.
Thank you for having me.
You published a study in 2011 with Dr. Ann Gager, also at Biologic Institute, which found that many mutations would be necessary for a protein to evolve into another. Could you describe what you did in that study and the importance of it?
Sure. I had in earlier work looked at the question of how hard it would be for evolution to stumble on a completely radically new protein, that is a protein that has a new structure. And what we wanted to do, because the answer that I got in that work was that it would be extremely hard for evolution to do that, we wanted to back up two steps and ask about a much simpler problem. So this is the problem of, consider an organism that has a bunch of proteins that work and they do their particular functions. How hard would it be for evolution to craft a new function on an existing structure? So to produce a slight modification of an existing protein that does a different job, does a different task in the cell. And so when we looked at this smaller question, both Ann and I thought it was quite conceivable that the answer would be that these sorts of things can evolve, and we really wanted to find out how long it would take for them to evolve. And we were somewhat surprised when we scanned the literature and looked at all the studies of this kind of thing and found that a lot of people had asked how hard it is to get a protein to move from one function to the next function. And all of these studies were unconvincing. At least they did not convince us that the evolutionary story could work, because they all found that these sorts of transitions, functional transitions that preserve the overall structure, are much harder than we would have thought. They take far more mutations, or despite all the efforts of these researchers, they couldn't actually get the transition to happen. But what we wanted to do is actually examine this thing from the perspective of people who are willing to offer a critique of Darwinism. So all of these prior studies, when they report the results that they get, they always fit them within the Darwinian paradigm and say, here we got an enzyme to perform a new function. And for various reasons, they were not convincing. We wanted to say, hang on, let's do this very carefully and be willing to draw the conclusion that, in fact, the Darwinian mechanism doesn't work. So what we did is just found out by experiment what sorts of changes it would take to get protein A, the first one, to do the function of protein B. And we ended up very carefully doing single changes and examining their effect and finding that it would require seven or more changes. And that doesn't sound like a huge number. Maybe it's eight or nine changes would make the thing work. We couldn't actually get it to work because we very carefully zeroed in on particular changes, and those did not get the transition to occur. But what it did allow us to do is to go back to a mathematical model and say, well, if to get this transition to happen would require, say, eight changes, how long would it take for that sort of transition to happen in a real bacterial population? And it turns out, once you get above the number six, and even at lower numbers, actually, but once you get above the number six, you can pretty decisively rule out an evolutionary transition, because it would take far more time than there is on planet Earth and larger populations than there are on planet Earth. So that was the big surprise. And we're the first ones that I know of who have undertaken a study of this kind and been willing to step back when we get the result and say, what does this mean for the paradigm? Is this possible or not? Everyone else has tried to force the results into the paradigm. We were willing to step back and say, maybe these results, ours and the results of others, actually challenge the paradigm. So that's what was really new.
Why is this study important, and what are its implications for Darwinian evolution?
I think the implications are much bigger than they seem when you first hear about the study. It looks like it's a study of enzymes, and it is, but we actually think of it as saying something important about invention and whether the Darwinian mechanism can invent new things or not. And of course, the most significant thing that the Darwinian mechanism is claimed to have invented is humanity itself. And so we actually think that the implications are quite staggeringly important. Everyone is aware that humanity as a species is radically different from everything else on the planet. I have an issue of New Scientist that came out at the end of April earlier this year that makes this very point. It says on the cover, "Our true nature, what peculiar animals we are." And it has a picture of a human, a gorilla, a macaque, and a goat all sitting down to dinner. And of course, all animals eat in one way. They just approach their food and eat it. And of course, they have slightly different styles, but they just tuck into their food. But we as humans do things so differently. We cook our food, we prepare it, we set the table, we invite others to join us. So we're radically different in something as basic as how we get our food and our nutrition. We turn it into a social event. We do all kinds of things in radically different ways as humans. And if you're a Darwinist, you have to believe that this most peculiar species, the human species, was invented by accident. And our study really tests how powerful the Darwinian mechanism is at invention by looking at something far less impressive than inventing humanity from the great apes, looking at something that is a simple transition of one molecule to another that has very much the same structure but performs a slightly different function. Another way you could think about it is we're looking at a molecular scale, a transition in function that does not involve a radical transition in structure. And you could liken that to the supposed transition that would have brought humanity out of the great apes. We have structurally similar bodies. We look a lot like chimps in terms of our basic body structure. But the behavior, the function of humans is so radically different from chimps. So it's kind of on a miniature scale asking whether that kind of transition can happen, and we got a decisive answer of no, it cannot, not in a Darwinian way.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about what is a multi-mutation feature?
I think the term that we've used in the technical literature is a complex adaptation. The idea is that everyone concedes that if you do enough change to DNA, you can get new functions to appear. The question is, how much change to the DNA, how much change to a genome do you have to do before you would get a new function to appear? And the classical Darwinian idea was that things can change in infinitesimally gradual way. Of course, once we knew that genomes are made of DNA and that DNA is encoding things like proteins, we know that the changes cannot be smaller than one base change. So once the modern synthesis was formulated in the first half of the 20th century, we realized that you can't divide things down infinitesimally. It comes down to single mutation events. So a multi-mutation feature or a complex adaptation is a new adaptive function that requires more than one mutation in order for it to appear in some given population. If it requires two mutations, it turns out to be much harder than if it requires only one, and three is much harder than two, and so on. It becomes progressively much, much harder every time you add a new mutation. So that's why it's significant to look at the number of mutations that it's required for a new function to appear.
You had talked earlier about six mutations and how long that would take, you know, to have a slight change, but a significant change to function. And yet now you're saying one mutation is hard, two is much harder, three is even harder than that. But you have to have six to get a relatively not that complex change. So I'm just imagining in my head a big change from one species to another.
Right.
You can quickly see how big the problem is.
It adds up very quickly. One turns out to be quite feasible. Two is where it starts to become a barrier for a lot of species. In bacteria, two is not a problem, but once you get above that, it becomes very, very much more difficult. And we were somewhat surprised at how many mutations are required for this really modest transition of function. If I were to show you these two enzyme structures that perform the starting function and the target function that we were looking at, you can superimpose them. You really have to study them to see the differences. They're that similar. So when you go beyond that, you're looking at much more radical inventions. You can imagine it just becomes ridiculously impossible, the number of changes you would have to make, and they would have to happen in a concerted way before there would be any benefit.
In the book, you use an analogy of a vehicle climbing a mountain. What does this have to do with evolution?
Well, I was trying to help people picture how the mechanism is supposed to operate. And the idea is you have a population that has very much the same DNA at any given time, and then there are these variants within the population that have slight changes in their DNA due to mutation. And natural selection is thought of as continually sifting through these variants and replacing the current version of the genome with any new one that happens to be more fit. And so it's kind of a hill climbing algorithm where everything stays stable, and if anything new appears that's better, then that replaces the existing genome and you jump to a new genome sequence. Well, since it's hill climbing, you could think of this in terms of a picture as a vehicle that's in one place, that's the location of the current genome, and it's maybe scanning the environment for a higher place to go jump to and go perch on a higher location. And it will stay where it is unless within its scan radius it sees a higher location to jump to. If it does, then it jumps to that location and it scans from there. That's kind of what the picture that I was trying to present was. But what turns out to be really interesting is if you look at where the interesting things to jump to are in biology, they are very far removed from any other thing. If you look at the separation between two species, they're radically separated in terms of their DNA. Even though they have much in common, their differences are very many in terms of the number of substitutions it would take to get one genome to convert to another genome. And then if you look at the limitation of this Darwinian vehicle that's doing the jumping, the key limitation is it can only search a very, very local region close to where it is. Actually, for most organisms, it would be within two mutations is the only region that it can search. So if you imagine that there are all sorts of hills out there that could be jumped to, but they're thousands of bases away, the little Darwinian vehicle will never make it there because it can only see such a small circle around its current location and jump to a higher peak there, and then it's stuck if it can't see anything higher from there. So that's the picture I was painting.
Has anybody ever figured out exactly how many mutations it takes to go from one species to another?
The interesting thing is that the idea that one species can turn into another and that you can keep jumping species to species until you've had a very substantial change of kind is itself an evolutionary idea, and it predates Darwin, but certainly it's an evolutionary idea. And interestingly, there's no scientific basis for it in terms of evidence. In other words, scientists assume that this is possible because the theory requires it. But if you ask any biologist, what evidence do you have that such transitions can occur, there's none whatsoever.
What's the take-home message of your chapter in this book? What is the one thing that you want people to take away from it and remember when they're open?
I think the one key thing is that I recognize that people find something seductive about the evolutionary story, and that is if you can point out similarities between things, then people find it at least intriguing, the idea that there can be transitions that go from A to B, because you see the similarities, and the similarities are certainly suggestive. A key take-home for me, that I would like people to get from reading the book, is that Darwinists really need to confront not the similarities, but the differences. To say that A and B are similar and that you have a theory that can explain the similarities is to say nothing at all, because similarities don't really need an explanation. What needs explanation is the differences in all of these transitions of going from A to B. So that is the key focus for us. In all of these substantial transitions of form, there are not only similarities, they are there, we grant that, but there are differences. Can Darwinism explain the differences? If I can get people to think about that and to realize how hard it is for Darwinism to explain even really, really modest differences, then I think we can change the way people think about this.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of ID the Future, a podcast of the Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. Please help us keep ID the Future online by donating at www.idthefuture.com. You can go there and click on the yellow donate button. Every contribution, no matter how small or large, will help us keep podcasting ID the Future. ID the Future is copyright 2012 Discovery Institute.